This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Steven Nadler about a wonderful book he published with Cambridge University Press called Spinoza Alive. This is the second edition of the book, which was published in 2018, and a paperback edition of the book was just published in 2022. Steven Nadler is an American academic and philosopher specializing in the 17th century philosophy. He's professor of philosophy and also Jewish studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steven, welcome to New Books Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we start, can you briefly tell us a little bit about your field of expertise and how you got interested in this area, and also more importantly, why you decided to write a book about Spinoza's life?
My work mainly focuses on philosophy in the 17th century and especially European philosophy. I've concentrated on figures such as Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, Cartesianism, and also in medieval Jewish philosophy, thinkers like Maimonides and Gersonides. My interest in early modern philosophy really goes back to my undergraduate days. My very first semester in college, the first class I took on a Monday morning, not having any idea what philosophy was about, was an introduction to philosophy class. And I had no idea what I was going to major in. And the class was so exciting to me, and especially because the professor was full of energy, full of enthusiasm, and made everything seem so vitally interesting that I immediately said, that's what I want to do. And he turned out to himself be a specialist in early modern philosophy. And after my graduation, he would go on to remain a mentor and later become a friend. And I think I owe a lot of my interests to his inspiration. I didn't initially work on Spinoza when I was in graduate school at Columbia in the early 1980s. My work was mainly on Descartes and Cartesianism, and I wrote a dissertation on a philosopher and theologian named Antoine Arnauld and his place in the development of Cartesian philosophy, that is, the philosophy of Descartes as it evolved in the later decades of the century. But after I received tenure and I felt I had a little more freedom to pursue interests that might not be regarded as typical narrow academic interests, I decided I wanted to write a book that would get read by more than, 15 or 20 specialists in the field. I wanted to reach a broader audience, but I also wanted to continue working in the 17th century philosophy. And I also had a desire to work on something that was a little bit closer to my own Jewish heritage. And so I noticed that there had never been a biography of Spinoza. And it seemed to be the perfect project. I could continue working on 17th century philosophy. I could look into into Spinoza's Jewish background and the history of the Amsterdam Jewish community. And biographies tend, if they're written well, and I hope mine was written well, tend to get written not just by read by fellow academics, but also by general readers who have an interest in philosophy or in history. It was really enjoyable to write. It was the first time I'd ever written a biography, not the last, and it was a very enjoyable experience.
And it was such an enjoyable book to read. I guess you have managed I've spoken with some friends of mine, and they were familiar with your book. So I guess you managed to get more people from the public to read the book. Let's talk about Spinoza's life. Where did his family come from? In the first chapter, you talk about his family's background. So can you tell us a little bit about his family and if they did they flee from Portugal in the 15th century?
They did. A lot of the Sephardic or Spanish and Portuguese Jews that were living in Amsterdam in the beginning of the 17th century were refugees from the Portuguese and Spanish Inquisitions in Iberia. In the late 15th and throughout the 16th century, Jews were forced to convert to Christianity. And a lot of these conversions were sincere and a lot were not. But sincere or not, the old Christians never really trusted the sincerity of these conversos. And the Inquisition took a very deep interest in what was happening behind closed doors. And so life became very difficult for these Portuguese and Spanish conversos. And throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, they fled the Iberian Peninsula to other places around the Mediterranean, such as Salonica, Fez, Italian cities. Many fled to Antwerp. But by the end of the 16th century, Antwerp was no longer a great place to be a converso. It was still part of the Spanish Empire, so you couldn't openly return to Judaism. But moreover, because of the Dutch Revolt, Antwerp's economic fortunes were very bleak. So a lot of these Portuguese conversos, and some were in France as well, ended up in Amsterdam. And that's basically the story of Spinoza's parents. They were born and raised in Portugal, but suffered under the Inquisition. And eventually ended up in Amsterdam. Spinoza himself was born in Amsterdam. And by the time he was born in 1632, there was a well-established Sephardic Jewish community in the city.
And speaking of biographies, there were some early biographers, right? You talk about two characters, Jean Maximilien Lucas and Johann Kohler, if I'm pronouncing the names correctly. What do they tell us about him that we wouldn't know now if they didn't tell us? And do you think they are reliable, accurate? And more importantly, what is their take towards Spinoza's ideas? Were they sympathetic or not?
Kohlerus was not sympathetic. Lucas was. And Lucas may have been overly sympathetic and may have made Spinoza's life to be a bit more heroic than it perhaps was. So I think we should read both of these early biographies, especially Kohlerus is from the 17th century and Lucas is from the early 18th century, with a grain of salt. Kohlerus, however, did lodge in the same house that Spinoza had lodged in, and so was able to converse with Spinoza's landlord. And that's a pretty good source of information. That's about as close as we get to firsthand information about Spinoza's manner of living. There were also reports from 1658 of two visitors to Amsterdam from Spain, independently of each other, who both claimed to have met and talked with Spinoza, and they relayed some of their conversations back in Spain to the Inquisitional authorities. And that's a source of some information, especially because that was just 2 years after Spinoza's cherem, or excommunication from the Jewish community. But all of these early modern, even contemporary sources really need to be read carefully. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of Spinoza's own firsthand autobiographical material. When he died in 1677 and his friends compiled posthumous editions of his writings, including his correspondence, they destroyed much of the correspondence that was personal in nature and published only the philosophical correspondence. So whatever Spinoza might have had to say about his own life, about his experience in the Jewish community, about his friendships, about his loves, if there were any, we really don't know. And the correspondence doesn't begin until 1661, which is already 5 years after the cherem. The only thing we really have is a brief autobiographical introduction to Spinoza's earliest writing, in which he makes some remarks about why he abandoned his career as a merchant and turns to the life of philosophy. So from all of these different sources, we try to cobble together, along with other historical sources, along with a good deal of notary documents about the family business, about legal issues, about his relatives, we can kind of cobble together a picture of his youth, of his education, because we have the record books from the Jewish community, which details who was paying what dues and what taxes, who was enrolled in what schools, who was studying where. And we also have the original document of Spinoza's Cherem. So from all of this, we can create a fairly compelling narrative of Spinoza's early years, his family background, his years in the education program of Jewish Amsterdam, and his time as a merchant. But again, it's all really a lot of recreation based on legal documents and secondhand reports.
Another part of the book that I really enjoyed myself was when you discussed the educational system, and you talk about how there was the Portuguese community that impressed this rabbi there, Rabbi Sabati. Well, please excuse me for my pronunciation. I'll leave it to you to say that. So can you talk about that educational system? And you also discussed Talmud Torah society that inspired that system.
Yeah, it was the Portuguese Jewish community's educational system was really remarkable. It was the pride of the community, but also admired around Europe. It consisted in taking young boys from the earliest age, training them in Hebrew letters, in the alphabet, introducing them to Torah readings, and then later other books of the Hebrew Bible. And then in the upper levels, lessons in Talmud and Rabbinic Midrash, and also very likely lessons in Jewish philosophy, readings from Maimonides and other figures. The rabbis who ran these classes were well-educated men. The chief rabbi, Saul Levi Mortera, was actually not a Portuguese Jew. He came to Amsterdam originally from Venice, where he was a rabbi. He ended up in Amsterdam and became the leader of this community, despite not being Sephardic, and was a learned figure in both rabbinic literature and in philosophy. The Talmud Torah Society was both an educational society charged with running the school system. It was also a scholarship society which raised funds to pay for the tuition of families who couldn't afford it. And it also became both a major scholarly library and a training ground for future rabbis. And so the word Talmud Torah can refer to a number of things: the charitable society, the educational system, the Rabbinic Academy, and now also the Etz Chaim Library.
You also discuss in the book the death of Spinoza's brother and how it impacted his life in terms of his religious studies and also his father's aspirations for him. How did it impact him?
Well, when his father died, Spinoza had to be the one to step in to take over the family business, because his older brother, Isaac, had also passed away, which meant that Spinoza could not attend the upper levels. As far as we know, he never got to do Talmudic study in the upper levels of the school system. He had to go into business. This is probably around the age of 16 or so, maybe 17. Any talk of Spinoza having trained to be a rabbi, there's no really foundation for that. He was, from an relatively early age, a businessman. The business did not do very well because it was saddled with a good deal of debt. The firm had suffered losses, partly because of a war with England, which interfered with Dutch shipping, which of course interfered with Jewish mercantile trade, which used Dutch shipping. We have records of many losses suffered by Michael de Spinoza, his father, during war with England. And then because Spinoza was really, when he took over the business, he inherited these debts. And at a certain point, he realized that he couldn't possibly meet his obligations. And so what he did was he took advantage of of a legal maneuver. According to Dutch law, you are a minor until you are 25. In 1656, Spinoza was only 23. And so in order to relieve himself of these debts that came with the business, and in fact, become a preferred creditor on his father's estate, that is somebody who would be paid before other creditors, he went to the Dutch courts and had himself declared an orphan. And that it did free him from his debts, but it also apparently caused a good deal of trouble within the Jewish community, because one of the regulations of the community was that business disputes should be handled internally into the community. You don't go to the Dutch authorities. One scholar has suggested that this legal maneuver that Spinoza pulled was the reason for the cherem, because by evading debts to both Jewish creditors and Dutch creditors, Spinoza was undermining the trust in the community and threatening its future as a place to do business. I don't think that was the reason behind the cherem. We could talk about that later, but it does show that Spinoza's time as a businessman was relatively short.
And I think it's a perfect segue to my next question, because it was about what instigated the Spinoza's ban or excommunication or cherem. And he's always been a controversial person. I think it was a few years ago that his books were banned again by a rabbi, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but I read about that a few years ago on the news.
Well, there was an incident about 2 years ago where an American Israeli Spinoza scholar went to Amsterdam as part of a filmmaking crew. He asked permission to film a film about Spinoza, and he asked for permission to do some filming within the synagogue complex. And the man who was the rabbi at the time said, "No, you may not. And not only that, you're now persona non grata." So it's not that Spinoza was put under cherem again, but moreover, that the rabbi who did this was not authorized to do it. It was an embarrassment to the community. That rabbi's contract was not renewed. The board of directors of the community were very angry that he had taken it upon himself. In 2015, though, there was a public event. One of the members of the congregation posed the question, should we now lift the ban on Spinoza? And so a committee of four people, myself and three others, we were asked to provide some reports on the background to the cherem. Who was Spinoza? What were his ideas? What were the circumstances of the ban? And also asked our opinion on whether the ban should be lifted. And we handed in our reports. Three out of the four of us said the ban should not be lifted, not because we're in favor of banning people, but because the circumstances of the ban are, first of all, mostly unknown to us. The cherem document only speaks of abominable heresies and monstrous deeds, but doesn't tell us what they are. But also Spinoza's response would say, I couldn't care less whether you lift the ban, you know. And moreover, a cherem is ostracism against a living person, so it's kind of meaningless to lift it now. And so the present day rabbi, not the rabbi who has since been fired, but the man who was a rabbi in 2015, said that he was not going to lift the ban. People are free to read Spinoza if they want to, but he's not going to lift the ban. And I think he rightly said, am I that much wiser than my 17th century colleagues that I know better than them? So let me just reiterate, I'm not in favor of banning people for their ideas. But given the circumstances of the ban in the 17th century, I think it was probably a justified reaction by a community that still felt a bit of insecurity as a refugee community in Amsterdam. Now, the reasons behind the ban, as I mentioned, are unclear, but I think we should take the language. First of all, it's an extremely long and vitriolic ban, much harsher than any of the cherems issued by the community in that period. It goes on and on with curses and damnations and expulsions and coming down upon the head of Spinoza. But it speaks of abominable heresies. And I think we should take that seriously. I think Spinoza, even though Spinoza had not written and certainly not published anything yet at that time, as far as we know, because again, he was just a businessman, we do have reason to believe that in conversations with fellow members of the community, he was expressing what would be regarded as heretical ideas about the nature of the Bible as a human document, about the validity of Jewish law, which he argues in his writings is no longer valid because the temple has been destroyed. There's no longer a Jewish commonwealth. And so all of these ceremonies and rituals about sacrifice and behavior in the commonwealth and how to govern an Israelite kingdom, these are all gone. So the law has lost its raison d'etre. And then finally, I think one of the more aggravating ideas of his was denying the personal immortality of the soul. And so if Spinoza was going around saying these things to people who asked him for his ideas, that to me probably would have been sufficient to warrant the cherem. And I think, in fact, is the reason why he was expelled with such prejudice.
What happened to him after the ban? Did he moved to Regensburg, right?
Rheinsberg, yes. Yeah, it's the Dutch pronunciation.
Yeah.
We don't know when he left Amsterdam, but by 1661, he's living in Rheinsberg, which is a small village near Leiden. And he took up lens grinding. And you can go to Rheinsberg today and visit the house he lived in, and it's set up like a little Spinoza museum. Then he moved from there. And I think he was there partly because he had developed friendships with these dissident Protestant people called the Collegians, not unlike Mennonites and Quakers. He didn't join them, but they had similar views about the nature of religion and ethics. And there was their leadership was in Rheinsberg, but it was also close to the University of Leiden, where we suspect he attended classes. Perhaps classes in human anatomy and so on. Then later he moved to Voorburg, which is a village outside of The Hague. And then in the final years of his life, he was living in The Hague. Probably went back to Amsterdam every now and then to meet with a circle of friends there and to discuss his manuscripts with them.
Yeah, the place where he took residence, there was this civil dispute in that city, right? He resided with someone called Daniel Tiedemann, and that was an interesting part of his life. And I'm sure our listeners would be interested to know more about that civil dispute that happened there.
Yeah, the dispute was about who was going to take over as pastor of the local church. We don't have a lot of the details, but some of the reports suggest that Spinoza favored a more dissident pastor over a conservative, a more orthodox one. And that apparently did not earn him the love of some members of the Rheinsberg community.
Mm. And how did he settle in the Dutch countryside? And more importantly, the question that I have is that he wrote his books, Ethics, but why did he decide to postpone its publication?
So he was working on the ethics from around late 1662, early 1663. And then he got just so far by 1665. But he was beginning to be troubled by various political developments in the Dutch Republic. He thought that, first of all, ecclesiastic authorities, the more conservative wing of the Dutch Reformed Church, were starting to exercise undue influence, not just on people's everyday lives, but on the civic life of the Republic. And this was a period in the Republic when there was war with England, France was threatening war. And so the more liberal regents who were governing many of the cities felt under threat from the other political camp, which are called the Orangists, because they favored the return of a stadtholder, the Prince of Orange. So from about 1652 to 1672, or thereabouts, there was no stadtholder. The previous stadtholder, Willem II, had died. And that ushered in a period that's called the True Freedom, where the more liberal regions governed, not democratically, it was more of an aristocracy or an oligarchy, but they governed with greater principles of toleration. And for those 20 years or so, there was no stadtholder, there was no central quasi-monarchical figure. But in 1672, when France invaded, the liberal side was defeated by the more conservative side, and a stadtholder, William III, the Prince of Orange, was reinstated. Now, that was 1672, but leading up to that, in the years from like 1665, Spinoza was concerned that freedom was growing less secure. And so he decided for a time to put aside the ethics and work on what he called a theological political treatise, in which he would try to undercut the authority of the conservative ecclesiastics by showing that the Bible is just a work of human literature, that miracles are impossible, that true religion has nothing to do with ceremonies and rituals and how you pray, but that true religion is just treating other human beings with justice and charity. But then also arguing that it's dangerous for a state when religious authorities begin to usurp political power. There should be no role in the civic governance for leaders of the church. On the contrary, it should be the civil authorities, the governors of the state, who exercise control over the public churches. So Spinoza put aside the ethics in 1665 and got to work on this theological political treatise, basically trying to defend his views on the relationship between religion and politics. That was published in 1670. And then Spinoza thought that that would pave the way for him to then get back to the ethics and publish that. But the scandal caused by the theological political treatise was so great. Critics pounced on it harshly. Ecclesiastic critics, political critics, even academic critics. One of his opponents called it a book forged in hell by the devil himself. Spinoza realized that given this outcry, and it was soon, even though the work was published anonymously, it soon became clear who the author was. He realized that it really would not be a good idea to try to publish the ethics, that it wouldn't get a fair hearing. It might even be dangerous to do so. So he ended up not publishing the ethics in his lifetime.
And he later on moved to Hague. Did he have any friends there in that city?
There are people he knew there, such as Christian Huygens, the scientist, and his brother. There was a good intellectual circle in The Hague. It was also the seat of political power in the Dutch Republic. It was also a convenient way for him to maintain his correspondence. It is interesting, why didn't he go back to Amsterdam? Because Amsterdam was a much more cosmopolitan city, and he had a circle of friends there. But for some reason, I think The Hague just proved more attractive to him, perhaps to be closer to the Huygens family, which was an influential and powerful family, or scientific circles in the city. But we really don't know why he chose The Hague over someplace else.
And you just mentioned his circle of friends in Amsterdam. And who were they, and what was their intellectual interaction in Amsterdam like?
They were a pretty varied circle. There were Mennonites, there were Collegians, probably some Quakers. They were generally liberal, tolerant, free-thinking individuals, some of whom were quite religious, but not in a conventional way, especially the Mennonites. Figures, and they were, some of them were people that Spinoza had gotten to know as a merchant. One of them was a grocer. And then there are people like Lodewijk Meyer, probably one of his closest friends, who was, as far as we can tell, not a man of deep religious piety, but really involved in the theater and arts scene in Amsterdam. Meyer would be one of the central people in helping to bring Spinoza's works to publication. And so these were people who were deeply devoted to Spinoza. I think Spinoza was somewhat charismatic and attracted very devoted friends. And they would meet regularly. Spinoza would send them manuscripts of his ethics, pieces of his work. They would meet to discuss it. They would write to Spinoza with questions. He would respond, and occasionally he would visit Amsterdam to meet with them.
Can you tell us about the last years of his life? What was it like? Where did he spend those years?
He spent them mostly in The Hague. In 1672, he witnessed the assassination of the De Witt brothers, who had been the more liberal leaders of the States Party, what's called the States Party, that is the non-Stadtholder, non-Orangist camp. But when France invaded, a mob assassinated the De Witt brothers, and then that's when William III was installed. Spinoza was actually a witness to this assassination. It was brutal. Their bodies were literally torn apart. And he was going to run out into the street and accuse them of being barbarians. But his landlord kept him and said, I don't think it's a good idea for you to go out there right now. It's probably dangerous. In The Hague, he entertained visitors. The philosopher Leibniz came through in 1676 on his way back from Paris and London to Germany. Spent a couple of days conversing with Spinoza. Spinoza also received an invitation to become a professor in Heidelberg, which he declined because he didn't think that that would give him the intellectual freedom. So it's not, there's a myth that Spinoza was this lonely, solitary thinker. I think that's really not the case at all. He enjoyed a broad correspondence. He entertained visitors. He had these close friends in Amsterdam. His health was never very good, however. He may have inherited some respiratory illnesses from his mother, but we also know that as somebody who spent a good deal of time grinding lenses, he was inhaling glass dust, which probably exacerbated whatever respiratory issues he may have had. And so he died quietly in 1677 in the house of his landlord at the age of 44.
Professor Steven Nadler, thank you very much for your time to speak with us on New Books Network. The book we discussed was Spinoza Alive, second edition, published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.